This episode of The Review was first broadcast on the 5th of January 2013. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller.
Ahead on today's programme, a cinematic survival guide to January as our visiting critics contemplate the best of this month's new releases.
So we visit every plantation until we find them. Once a final brutal brother lies dead in the dust, I agree to give you your freedom and I'll take you to rescue your wife.
Also ahead, this week's guest music reviewer joins us from Tel Aviv to tell us what's rocking the Kasbahs in the Middle East. While you're looking astray, while ignoring the pain, life
happens while surrendering to peace. And IHT theatre critic and regular guest Matt Wolfe will be telling us which Broadway shows you should be taking bouquets to and for which ones you should be packing last week's tomatoes.
So lots to look forward to this week here on The Review on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Studio One at Midori House. You're listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller, and Emma Nelson. Hello and Happy New Year, Emma Nelson.
Happy New Year, Andrew Muller. How was your cultural Christmas?
It was largely confined to the in-flight entertainment on Cathay Pacific.
And how was it?
Actually pretty good.
Good.
I did see several episodes of The Newsroom, which I hadn't previously seen, the much-discussed and somewhat criticised Aaron Sorkin thing set in a newsroom, hence the title. I quite liked it. It's basically more of the kind of overwritten liberal pornography that he sort of became famous for on the West Wing. But I'm a terrible sucker for that sort of thing.
My cultural Christmas is generally spent hoovering up the stuff that I should have seen all year. And so I have effectively locked myself in the house and I'm now going through Homeland Series 1. Having been disappointed by Series 2, I thought I'd better go and look at the first one to see what it was all the fuss was about. And I can honestly say the washing up is undone, the house is dirty, the washing is unwashed. I am addicted to watching Homeland.
Is Series 1 better than Series 2?
Series 1 is brilliant. Absolutely
really?
Brilliant. I'm sure I'm now telling everybody who obviously saw it when it first came out, but if anybody has a spare week in an evening, just go and watch Homeland from beginning to end in the evenings. I'm going through 3 episodes a night.
See, I saw the first 2 episodes and thought it was very silly, but
it is.
The Israeli series on which it is based, Prisoners of War, I saw when it was broadcast in the UK earlier this year and enjoyed very much.
It's one of those series that you have a willing suspension of disbelief and you embrace that suspension.
Okay.
It's great. It's absolutely great. Fantastic acting, great writing. What telly is all about. We are, however, going to talk about film next, with the time just coming up to 7 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to The Review, and it is the first show of the year, and January is traditionally the time when, emerging blinking from behind the Christmas tree, having successfully alienated the last and most tenacious of our house guests, we head to the cinema. This new year offers several highly anticipated new releases, including Catherine Bigelow's take on The Raid That Killed Osama Bin Laden, Quentin Tarantino's take on slavery, and Steven Spielberg's take on Abraham Lincoln. Plus, Russell Crowe, despite the fearsome warning to posterity that was his rock and roll career, insists on singing again.
Well, joining us now in the studio are the critics Karen Krasanovich and Tim Roby. Welcome to you both. Tim, these are all huge, great films that are coming out in January, isn't it? We have a feast ahead.
It's heavyweight kind of Oscar prestige movie season. They all weigh in. That's, you know, in one corner you've got Tarantino tackling the specter of slavery with Django Unchained. Opposite him you have Spielberg tackling the abolition of the 13th Amendment, the abolition of slavery.
So slavery. So
it's slavery month in those corners. And then and then you have Les Mis, a different kind of uprising
going on
there.
So the kind of slavery for anybody who's stuck in the cinema, so many of the critics.
Yes, indeed, yeah. But it's a great time to be going to the cinema, I must say. I think January is often the best month of the year for films in the UK.
This one is particularly interesting insofar as each film that we're going to have to talk about addresses big events in history. And so people are, Tarantino is taking slavery and sort of blowing it to pieces in Django Unchained. And then we have Spielberg trying to write history, which is one of my great hates of Spielberg, is that he tries to create history out of film. Why do you think they've all decided to go for for fact so strongly this year?
Well, I think there's a lot of heavy, with The Hobbit coming up and everything, there is a lot of heavy fantasy. Think about what's just gone. We've had Twilight, we've had all of these, I don't want to say fanciful, but you know, it's not real, okay? and I think that they're trying to make cinema more important in a way. It's actually a fast track to history. For me, I don't know a lot of history, I have to say. Geography and history, I'm weak. But if I go see a movie and if my interest is pricked, I will go and actually, I might even go to Wikipedia. I might even go that far. But I do think it's kind of educative. I mean, it's an entertaining way of giving people important messages. And I think that's why they're doing it.
Does Spielberg do that with Lincoln, though? Because he does have a tendency, especially when addressing American history, to try and frame everything as some sort of sappy morality play. He was, interestingly, much more ambiguous on Munich, addressing, I guess, Israeli history. Well, but where does he land with Lincoln?
Well, Lincoln has the same screenwriter as Munich, which is Tony Kushner, who wrote Angels in America, who's a real sort of heavyweight thinker and playwright and clever man. And he's researched it beautifully. And I think it doesn't feel sappy. It doesn't feel sentimental. It does have a certain heft, a certain kind of old-fashioned American heft to it.
With the possible exception of Washington, Lincoln is the most routinely and unquestioningly venerated of American presidents.
That's right. What this does, though, is rather than kind of tackling the whole of his life, it pinpoints one moment, one key moment, when he wanted to push through the 13th Amendment at the one time when he felt it could actually be achieved, which was before the war ended. Everyone's expecting the war to end. As soon as the war ends, there's no need for the amendment, really, because they kind of think, well, we've sort of dealt with that. We don't need to worry about that now. And he's like, well, no, this is the very moment when we can get this through. We've got to do it. And that's a kind of quite an exciting and pivotal moment. And it doesn't venerate him too much. And it's actually the film, even though Daniel Day-Lewis is really, really good as Lincoln, it's more of an ensemble piece than you're expecting when you go in, because there's all these other people on different sides of the aisle fighting the other side of the argument. And there's also Tommy Lee Jones, who's fantastic in it as well, as someone who's on Lincoln's side.
Well, it's importantly based on Doris Keen Goodwin's book, which is focuses exactly on this issue. And I think that coupled with a good screenwriter makes it less pablum than you may think. But he also, don't forget, he's a popular filmmaker. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that you have to say, well, we're just going to have something soppy for the cheap seats, for the people who really aren't paying attention, and for the more serious people, we're going to have this. I think he's really trying to do both things. He's trying to teach everybody something. And you've got to have a little bit of...
It's less sentimental than either of his other two films about slavery, The Color Purple and Amistad.
Yeah.
It's less sort of, I don't know, it's less emotionally sort of soppy than
but
either
this
of those.
I get the impression, too, that he's been working on this one a lot longer than he has. I mean, film things are usually worked on for years and years and years and years. I mean, a friend of mine did 7 years in Tibet, it took him 14 years to make it, you know, and that's not uncommon. But this has been gestating for a long time. So I think the focus is really quite interesting and quite sharp.
One of the problems I often have with Spielberg is the imposition of a narrative on history that Spielberg is, like you say, is a popular filmmaker, so he has to give you a narrative. But you can sometimes just see it screaming at you through the screen. You mentioned there, Tim, the fact that he has this race against time. He's got to get the 13th Amendment through before the end of the Civil War. How much does that actually colour the film? Does it become less of a piece of history and more of a really gripping drama?
It is a gripping drama in a kind of courtroom drama sort of sense. It's quite dry, and you go through an awful lot of exposition. You kind of learn a lot of the nitty-gritty. But it's also a case of everyone wrangling to get their point across best. And it's about the kind of the ways that politicians will manipulate their argument the best way for them to make their case well. That is really good. So there's almost a West Wing element to it there. It's about spin.
Absolutely.
It's the early days of spin, if you like, in American politics.
It's very clear that Lincoln, he talks as a lawyer. Most of the time he brings up lawyer terms and legal terms, which I think... But there's also an element of Tim Blake Nelson and James Spader and I can't remember the other guy. They're not exactly lobbyists, but they're running around trying to change people's minds. And that was quite comic. And as part of a... You could almost see kind of... what we see as a noble endeavor of Lincoln trying to do this actually had just as cheesy, cheap elements as anything else.
And the other, they make quite a comical point out of Lincoln's habit of just constantly resorting to all these anecdotes. He'll just sit back and say, this reminds me of it, and everyone sort of groans because they've heard these so many times, which is quite funny.
I mean, the obvious opposition to Lincoln, or at least the obvious counterpoint to it, is Tarantino's take on broadly the same period. Is there any point of comparison at all, or is this Tarantino, at the risk of sounding crass, doing for slavery what Inglourious Basterds did for the Holocaust?
God, well, that's a pretty good comparison, really. Well, you know, we don't need to talk about it anymore. No, of all the films that I'd rather see again, I would rather see Lincoln. I'm not as fond of Tarantino as Tim is, and I'm watching Django for me was like watching 3 hours of television from my youth. And I just didn't need to see. And people come up to me, Tarantino's invented cinema. Did you know that? Oh, really? There are some fun moments in it, but I just found it really a bit of lightweight fluff. And I know everybody's upset with his use of the N word, but now go on, take over.
Oh, for me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, it's dynamic as well. It has momentum, and I think it's better than Inglourious Basterds, which I thought was sort of two competing films in a way.
Yes,
that there's one, the Brad Pitt stuff in Inglourious Basterds, and then the Christoph Waltz stuff. They never really meet. It's as if he didn't decide which film to make. Whereas here, he really has decided. Mm-hmm. And Christoph Waltz, who is amazing in it again, and really kind of shares the screen with Jamie Foxx in almost every scene. They are a double act. It's about the two of them, and it's about this strange relationship between this guy whose job it is to, you know, go and hunt down errant slave owners, and then this actual freed slave who he brings along with him to help him do the job.
Mm. Let's have a listen to a little bit of Django Unchained.
They caught my wife, and they sold her, but I don't know who to.
That means we visit every plantation until we find her.
Once a final brutal brother lies dead in the dust, I agree to give you your freedom, and I'll take you to rescue your wife.
Where are we going?
Yes! Woo!
Gentlemen. You had my
gunshots and a sexy soundtrack. It could only really be a Tarantino film, this being Django Unchained. Karen, you mentioned that you said it was you felt like you were watching a film from your youth. Mm. One thing that I've always had struggled with Tarantino is that I never got past Pulp Fiction. I thought he'd said everything he had to say by the time he'd done Pulp Fiction. And I'm wondering how fresh something like Django Unchained is.
Well, I mean, he's obviously not making movies for me. And I wonder actually where he would be without Christoph Waltz, who lifts him. It's like seeing a really ugly guy with a really beautiful woman. And you think, wow, there's something got to be going on there because Christoph Waltz is so amazing. And I do think that Tarantino's turned into a one-trick pony. He doesn't surprise me anymore. Some of the visuals are nice, but he steals them from other movies. And I just feel it's this huge recycling. He's almost like this sort of Warhol small W of the cinema now.
I mean, Spike Lee, despite not having had the benefit of actually seeing it or anything, has described it as disrespectful in its treatment of what is obviously a serious subject. Is this Spike Lee? Does he have a point, or is he being a pompous blowhard?
Watch the movie and then talk. I didn't even read that when I heard that he was slagging it off, and he probably hadn't even seen a clip on YouTube. But I'm thinking, you know, Spike, shut up.
If there's one part of the movie that I would criticize quite strongly, it wouldn't actually be the use of the N-word. It would be actually the last half hour, where I think it tips over. I don't want to give too much away, but it tips over into kind of classic Tarantino overkill. Mm-hmm. For 2 hours, it's actually quite morally complex because you have Christoph Waltz squaring off against Leonardo DiCaprio, who is this hugely corrupt figure. But so is Waltz, and they're corrupt in different ways, and they're kind of actually mortal enemies by the end. But then after that, it becomes just massive kind of childish retribution, kind of vendetta,
which is effectively what Tarantino actually specializes in.
That's right.
You have retribution, you know, sown through every single one of his
films.
That's
right. I'm waiting for a film in which he begins, just steps back for a moment and says, is revenge actually the solution to all situations that I create? Because this film eventually just gives in and says, oh yeah, we'll do this again.
He's going to remake Gandhi, you know that. No, just kidding. I would love to see him make a movie without using blood. Wouldn't that be nice? I mean, I was sitting there thinking, this is Blazing Saddles with blood. I don't need
that kind of sells me on it, I must say. I want to see it again.
Blazing, right? Bad Blazing Saddles.
Or if he just makes a film which is 2 hours of him counting his money and laughing at the kids who beat him up at school.
And wearing women's shoes. Always wins me over.
He's before, in it as well. And before he's,
this, oh, he is in it.
Bad.
That's right. Yeah. He's not playing a horse, unfortunately.
Before this descends into anything more puerile than Tarantino himself is being accused of being. Let's move on to Zero Dark Thirty. Again, a film which approaches a historical event.
And retribution.
And retribution. And blood. But obviously, Catherine Bigelow, straight off the success of the very brilliant Hurt Locker, then decides that she's going to do the moment that Osama bin Laden is killed. Tim, what was your take on it?
I think it's really tremendous. And I think, talking about people who come in and criticise the film without having seen it, there's been a lot of this, particularly in America. There's been accusations that it somehow glorifies the whole mission to take bin Laden down. I think it actually does the opposite. It's an incredibly sad film, and the ending is kind of brutal and devastating, and leaves you reeling. You don't come out with in any way feeling that a kind of triumphant victory has been scored, and nor do you feel that about the torture scenes at the beginning, which have been quite controversial because they've factually conflated certain things that happened to make it seem as though possibly this one bit of information was actually gleaned under duress, under waterboarding. But for the most part, the film reminds me a lot of David Fincher's Zodiac, which was about the hunt for a serial killer over many, many years, massively inconclusive and kind of completely fatiguing and exhausting to everyone involved. This is what this film is. Again, it's the whole decade-long search for bin Laden. So you go through a lot of kind of procedural stuff and dead ends everywhere, and it's as if everyone is tearing their hair out. And finally, they get hold of this one lead that takes them where they want to go. Mm. And the finale, I think, is one of the best things that Catherine Bigelow has ever done. Not because it's kind of all guns blazing, but because it's incredibly dark. It's almost invisible. And you're led into this compound where it all happened. And it's just the kind of the sense of apprehension and the unknown is completely palpable and brilliant.
Well, the comparison with Zodiac is really good. You're really good, you know that? I agree completely. And another thing is that this film is made for people, whether you didn't really know anything about the hunt for Osama bin Laden, or you know everything about the hunt for Osama bin Laden. For me, there was a comic moment at the end. All I could think of was Woody Allen's Sleeper, because they've got the leader's nose, but that's as far as I'm going to say. It was incredibly tense. I think it says a lot about women in a man's world. Jessica Chastain's character, is it really a woman? Is it not really a woman? How factual is that? That's been thrown up a lot. And it's really, I mean, I heard years ago that terrorists or SWAT teams, when they come to kill terrorists, they always kill the women first because the women are the most vicious. And if you've ever seen women fighting over in a sale, you'll know.
Not wrong.
No, I'm just kidding.
Let's have
no
a quick
rules.
Listen.
Go on.
You really believe this story? Osama bin Laden?
Yeah.
What part convinced you?
Her confidence.
If you're right, the whole world's gonna want in on this.
Clip there from Zero Dark Thirty. For the benefit of those who haven't seen it, where does she find the kind of, I guess, the moral ambiguity of this? Because you don't necessarily need to be a sort of flag-waving Team America headbanger to perceive the demise of Osama bin Laden as basically a good thing.
Moral ambiguity.
Well, it's not so much moral ambiguity, but it's a question of the human cost on both sides. So it's okay. Not only that the people, you know, the CIA team spend their whole lives on this and kind of have no other life, which is sort of the point of Jessica Chastain's characterization. It's also that when they're in the compound, there are all these kids there and there are all these women there, and they're watching their husbands getting gunned down, and they're in like terrible and palpable distress. So it doesn't flinch away from showing that, you know, these are husbands, these are fathers who are being killed, and we don't come away kind of thinking hooray, to be honest with you. We come away thinking that it was a bad job, but someone had to do it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, all this time, you know, we've got to find this guy, but you know, we're not revisiting visuals of the Twin Towers or anything like that. We're not. And by the time they get there, it's sort of like, gosh, we're in somebody's house. You know, so
you mentioned a moment ago that the amount of factual conflation that occurs inside the film, and much has been made for, you know, more than a year now about the access that Catherine Bigelow was given. And people were quite worried that she had had too much. How much of that is evident in the film, or how much are you sitting there thinking, did this really happen? Did this not? Where do you sit with it?
Yeah, it's tricky that, because you kind of come away, if you don't know that much about it, and I will admit I didn't know that much of the nitty-gritty going in, you come away thinking, this feels very scrupulously researched. Mm-hmm. And then you look into it and you realize, well, it was, but it was researched through certain channels, and they were totally trusting in those mm-hmm. channels. So there are possible arguments they might have been misled mm-hmm. slightly in some directions about the use of waterboarding and certain very kind of, you know, hot potato flashpoints in kind of American.
Well, she also had to rewrite it really quickly.
Yeah.
Because it was initially about the hunt for Osama bin Laden, and they got him, and then, whoa, can you imagine? She must have got up that morning at 3 a.m. and said, we've got to change this script.
And where do you think that will leave the film in the future when people look back at it?
I think it'll stand as a piece of I hate to call it entertainment, but as a look at an important historical event, I suppose, just like Lincoln.
To return to a phrase we were tossing around there earlier, a dirty job which someone has to do, we probably should move on to Les Miserables. I'm not a big musicals guy, in the same way that I'm not a big banging nails into my forehead guy. So for people who are a big musicals guy, how does this sit?
I guess I kind of am a musicals guy, and I do like this show. I like the show. I've seen it twice on stage. I think the film is pretty much unspeakable.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think it's so horrendously directed, and the casting misfires in so many ways that I just thought that they botched the musical.
Now,
really.
It's being sold as the first film that Tom Hooper, the director of The King's Speech, has done since doing The King's Speech, which was, of course, a good film. And much has been made about the fact that Les Miserables is going to be reinventing the musical on screen, that they made all the actors sing, which one would hope they would do anyway. But you say it's absolutely terrible. Where does it fail?
It really, for me, it makes almost all the wrong choices in terms of direction and start. There are a few little moments I would single out that are exceptions. I think Anne Hathaway does a very nice job with I Dreamed a Dream, which mm-hmm. is the song they used to sell it with the first trailer, because it really does stand out. And she'll win Best Supporting Actress just for that one song. I can see it happening. And I also thought Eddie Redmayne did quite a nice job as the romantic lead. But most of the other casting is kind of disastrous. So we all know Russell Crowe can't sing. You go in not expecting him to be able to sing. He gives a very stolid
really
performance.
Can't sing. Oh, really? I mean, he really can't sing.
The shock is that Hugh Jackman, who's meant to be able to sing, is doing this kind of Broadway nasal mm-hmm. routine, which is so wrong for that role, you cannot believe it.
But the two scenes that work are filmed exactly the same way, which I think is amazing. And of course, you're sitting there thinking, she still isn't talking about the diet where she lost 25 pounds.
Which everybody's been looking, anyone who's read a newspaper in the last 1 year will know of the Anne Hathaway Les Miserables diet. That was the one thing that's actually sold the film more than anything
else. She doesn't want the anorexics to get a hold of it, I'm pretty sure. But I went to see it, and I know nothing at all about the musical. But I like my musicals hummable, right? I like to hum. And then I'm thinking, oh, da, 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 da. And they're doing it live, which is great. But it's like they're talking, singing at you. And Russell Crowe, I just said, please stop anytime. And also, as Tim was pointing out to me earlier, as we were discussing it, I know we shouldn't, but we were in the green room, saying that a lot of these were supposed to be ensemble pieces, and they've necessarily had to be solos. I don't think this is the way that musicals are going to be going, but it's a real divider, because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
Let's take a listen.
I'm cold. Would you let me stay here for tonight? I know who you are. You're Jean Valjean.
Trumpet!
Right, my girl. On your way.
I had a dream my life would be.
Help me, please. I have a child.
So different from this hell I'm living. So different.
I'm pretty sure that's about as much of it as I'm ever going to hear.
Did you hear the horse? Sounded real good. I thought who
played the horse? He was excellent.
That was Jack. Okay. He's a famous horse.
Is this a problem with musicals on film, though? Because we were talking about this before we started this program, saying that probably Moulin Rouge kind of worked, but others you get real, it kind of work with reservations, but others just don't. The transfer just doesn't seem to be very successful.
But you think about West Side Story or anything like that, and you just think these are really great. I just felt they were kind of gabbling through the whole thing and not singing.
I think for every musical that does work, Chicago is another one that people kind of liked. There are two or three that really fail. Nine, for instance, the Daniel Day-Lewis film, and also the Phantom of the Opera. This one reminded me of that more than any of the others, to be honest with you. It just felt like a real missed opportunity to me, and I'm surprised that everyone's lapping it up so much. I'm particularly surprised that people who love the show aren't looking at it and thinking, why do they do it this way? And it just feels so unepic.
And it's got a Tim Burton movie buried right in the middle of it.
Yeah.
No, sorry.
On that appetizing note, Karen Krasanovich and Tim Robey, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back after this short break to suggest five January exhibitions you should think about going to see, depending on where in the world you are. Do stay tuned.
On Monocle's culture show, we want to be like the fabled Hydra, one of the great monsters of Greek myth, but in a good way. Listen to one fascinating story and two more eagerly pop up to replace it. So it's only scary if you're frightened of the following sorts of things. Reports from all over the world on art, books, magazines, media, music, film, publishing, advertising, and photography. Or if you're terrified of beautifully performed, intimate live music sessions from some of our favourite acts recorded in our performance space right here at Midori House. It's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. It premieres on Mondays at 1900 London time, and frankly, it's the heroic Hercules that defeats the evil Hydra of radio boredom. Join us and enjoy the legend.
And you're with The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller. It is time to cross to our associate editor, Nelly Gocheva. She'll be talking us through some of the international art exhibitions you might want to see this January. Take it away, Nelly.
To kick off 2013 here on The Review, here are five exhibitions to check out in the coming days. In Tokyo, Impossible Project Space is hosting a collection of 42 photos by the renowned Japanese photographer Daido Moriyama. The exhibition is named White and Vinegar, as Moriyama once stated that in a world without film and chemicals, he would mix egg white and vinegar in the sun to create his photos. However, his new abstract series was shot using Impossible Project's new generation film, and it is also available in a book of the same name. The exhibit is on until the 27th of January. Seoul's Museum of Art is the final stop of the Tim Burton exhibition that first originated at MoMA New York and has now visited London, Paris and LA, among other cities. It showcases 862 of Burton's works, including sketches, paintings, film clips, sculptures, music and costumes from now-turned classics such as Edward Scissorhands, The Nightmare Before Christmas and Ed Wood. The show is on until the 14th of April. In Hong Kong, the Gagosian Gallery is hosting the Flowers and Skulls exhibit by Japanese artist Takashi Murakami, famous for his pop and manga-influenced style. Murakami's work explores the overlapping emotions found in both joy and terror through the recurring images of smiling flowers and morbid skulls. For more information, go to gagosian.com. New York's Museum of Modern Art has put together a new show called Inventing Abstraction from 1910 to 1925. The exhibition is celebrating abstract art with over 350 pieces, from paintings to poems and from dance to sculptures. Kandinsky, Mondrian and Duchamp are a few of the artists featured in the show, which is on until the 23rd of April. And finally in Toronto, check out Steve Driscoll's North Swallow exhibition at the Angel Gallery. Inspired by a road trip in the US, the Canadian-born painter re-envisions the landscape of his native Ontario. The large-scale contemporary paintings employ a vivid palette to attribute an animated sense to the great wild landscape. North Swallow is on until the 12th of January. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gocheva.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24, and it's time now for our weekly music review.
We can cross to Tel Aviv to catch up again with a regular Review music contributor. Joining us on the line, I'm pleased to say, is Nadav Ravid, Israeli DJ and producer. Nadav, welcome back to The Review. A very happy new year to you. What have you been up to?
Thanks very much. Well, I've been moving flats lately, and so I've been all up to that. But apart from that, I've released a new album with my band and been DJing around Tel Aviv and trying to catch up with new Israeli music for your show today.
Well, we'll be talking a bit about those tracks shortly, but introduce, if you will, the Israeli music scene in general, because it's not something that's often heard from outside Israel.
Well, it's kind of complicated to introduce a whole scene. You know, it's splitted into various sub-scenes and many sub-genres, and each kind of sociological part of the Israeli demography is interested in different kind of music. So it's really hard to say, you know, what's going on in a few words. But I can say that there is, you know, from my point of view, there's a very boring mainstream pop music and a lot of interesting indie music, which not much of it is getting heard of in the mainstream, but a lot of talent in there.
There is also a very buoyant club scene in Tel Aviv, isn't there?
Yeah, it's true. I've just been clubbing this Thursday to DJ Harvey from New York in one of the best clubs in the world called The Block. It has an amazing sound system. Many DJs who came to play over there were amazed by the sound system. People like Giles Peterson and other American DJs. A lot of them are really impressed with the sound system and recommending it to many other DJs to come and play there later.
You were talking there about that, I guess, divergence between a boring mainstream and a slightly more lively alternative sector, which is not, of course, peculiar to Israel. But how pervasive, I guess, is that boring mainstream sector? How hard is it for a left of field, say, indie rock group in Israel to get noticed in Israel?
It's very, very hard for many reasons. First of all, the population which is interested in pop and rock music in general is much smaller than other countries. So to begin with, you are targeting a smaller audience. The media is smaller, so you have less channels to help yourself with, and so it's really hard to get noticed on TV and on the main internet websites. So you have to do it on your own. And there are not so many venues for playing this kind of music as well. So it's a lot of hard work if you want to get noticed.
Well, let's hear your first choice, Elektra, Time and Place. Elektra have been described as the best new band in Israel. Are they making this crossover into the mainstream?
Well, actually, they are in a small way, but they do. They've been around for almost 10 years now, but they've only released their first album a couple of years ago, their first full LP, and they've just released their second LP a couple of weeks ago. And because they're really, really hardworking people, and they're touring a lot, and not just in Israel, and they've been playing a lot, and they've really honed their skills, and a lot of people became interested in what they have to offer, and even on the radio, they managed to break through, not to the major playlists, but for instance, their tracks are being heard in the evening time a lot on the main sort of pop music station in Israel.
Okay, well, let's hear the track you've picked. This is Elektra with Time and Place.
And that was Elektra, Time and Place, the choice of Nadav Ravid, Israeli DJ and producer, and our guest reviewer on today's review here on Monocle 24. Nadav, why did you choose that particular track, or does everything that Elektra produce have that sort of fresh sound to it?
Well, all the things they do have a very fresh approach. They pick and mix from a lot of retro influences and manage to make something new out of it with a very strong pop attitude to it, but not losing the sort of raw and kind of more interesting angle to it as well. And this is basically the last single from the album. And I gave you two tracks to pick from, and this is the one you chose. And it's a great track. And they cooperate here with another pop singer from Israel called Emily Karpel. She's singing the female voices here.
The second track you've picked for us today is Estorada. Before we play a bit of this track, tell us a bit about Estorada. Who is she?
Esther is a young actress doing a lot of TV series in Israel. Still hasn't managed to break into the big time, but she got noticed on some of the better TV series, the Israeli produced TV series around. And she's also been a singer for many years, and she's now working on her first album together with Kutiman. I don't know if you remember the YouTube project Through You, which Kutiman is one of the is the person behind it, and he's also a very talented musician. And together with his friend Sabo, they're both producing her album, and it's a great soul R&B album with a very Middle Eastern vibe to it as well.
It has a very strong mixture of the fact that she was born in Israel but has an Ethiopian heritage. Let's have a listen to her track.
While you're looking astray, while ignoring the pain, love happens. While surrendering to fear, while holding back the tears, it's an everlasting
the Ethiopian Israeli singer Estorada with Life Happens, the second choice of today's guest music reviewer, Nadav Ravid. Nadav, your third choice is Flora. Tell us a bit about Flora.
I don't know much about her. I've heard her name popping up a few times in the last couple of years since she released her first album. And I've been hearing more and more about her in the last few months. And I've decided to check her out and found amazing musician doing kind of sort of intimate, fragile, electronic singer-songwriter kind of music. And she's also about to release her second album next year, early next... Well, we're already in 2013, early this year. And she released this single a couple of weeks ago, and it's a beautiful song.
What interests me about your choices today, Nadav, is that we've pretty much straddled pretty much every kind of musical genre that you can think of. We had the retro sound of Electra, then we've just had that soulful Middle Eastern sound of Estorada, but now Flora is it's all synth pop, isn't it?
She's sorry, Emma.
It's a very very synth. It's a electro sound.
Yeah, it's much more electronic and a bit more left field, I suppose, from all the three. But I think it just goes to show how varied is the scene around here.
Well, let's have a listen to her track. This is Flora and It's a Lie. That was the sound of Flora and her track It's a Lie, the final choice of Nadav Ravid, the Israeli DJ and producer on today's review. Nadav, just one final thing before we go. You mentioned at the beginning of this interview that there is that difficulty of the number of outlets available to people when they want to get their music. You've just been working with an online station. Tell us about that.
You mean our station, KZ Radio?
Indeed.
Yeah, well, we've been, a friend of mine and me have been hosting an alternative music show on the main pop station in Israel for about 13 years. It was late at night. We did it twice a week. He was doing Sundays and I was doing Tuesdays. And essentially, we were cut out last year, and we decided that we have a big crowd and we still want to do that. And we assembled a team of some of the best radio DJs and music people in Israel, and started this new initiative exactly 9 months ago. And we've been doing it every day. There's a new show every day, and all the music is being available online. And we mainly play alternative music from all around the world, but there's a very, you know, big percentage of Israeli music as well, especially on the Monday show. And, you know, we try to get in touch with musicians in Israel. They get in touch with us, but still it's still limited in the way that, you know, we don't have this much of exposure as we would like to have. It's still pretty small. You know, it's still very effective, but it's not as big as, you know, we want it to be.
Well, we wish you all the very best with that. Nadav Ravid in Israel, thank you very much, as ever, for joining us here on The Review.
We're going to take a short break right now, but don't go away, because in just a moment we will be joined by the reliably charming Matt Wolf of the International Herald Tribune, who's going to guide us through which New York theatre shows we should be seeing this January. Stay tuned.
The latest culinary trends, restaurants with the best food, the coziest cafes, and the makers behind them. The menu tells you all you need to know about the world of cuisine and drinks, and the people who are doing things differently. Hours London time, or download the shows from Monocle's website.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Krug.
Welcome back. It's Saturday. It's about 12:46, in fact, on Saturday here in London, and you're listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller, and Emma Nelson.
Now, while many of us were reaching for the third slice of thickly buttered Christmas Kringle, or indeed the seventh glass of port, our next guest spent most of the festive season stuffing himself silly with theatre in New York. He has digested it all and has returned to London lithe and full of views. Matt Wolf from the International Herald Tribune, as ever, a very warm welcome to the studio and a very happy new year.
And to you, Emma. Thank you very much.
A very busy festive season for you.
Yes, it's interesting that New York doesn't really seem to toast the holiday as much. Everyone's busy running around to Christmas movies and of course, going to the theater. And that's partly because it's a very productive time of year financially for producers. And so they open a lot of stuff right before the holidays. And then it's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close. And there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
Was there an overriding theme to what was being put on show this Christmas?
I think there was in that Broadway, and this is not new, but Broadway was hosting the stars. You wanted the big names, you went to Broadway and you paid through the nose for it. And if you wanted some of the really quality stuff, you went off Broadway. Or if you wanted the quality stuff on Broadway, you went to the not-for-profits, not the commercial theater.
Can we start by talking a bit maybe about the high-profile flops, mostly because high-profile flops just amuse me no end.
Yeah.
What's been the highest profile and the floppiest?
Well, the highest profile has probably been the closing, actually it'll close tomorrow,
tonight.
Sunday, January 6th, of Katie Holmes's return to Broadway for the first time since she parted company from Tom Cruise in a play called Dead Accounts, which probably is synonymous with the producer's bank balance on this production, a play in which she appears as a stay-at-home Ohioan in Cincinnati who's visited by her antic manic brother, played by the wonderful Norbert Leo Butz, who's gone to New York and hit the big time and come back home to have his values tested by his sister and his mom. And, you know, all credit to Katie Holmes, actually, for sort of wanting to tell the world that she's not joined at the hip to Mr. Cruise and that she can sort of strut her stuff on Broadway. She has done a Broadway show before, a revival of Arthur Miller's All My Sons. And actually, she's perfectly decent in the play, which doesn't ask a whole lot of her. But the play is just very, very thin gruel, and it's clear that it would never have got to Broadway without her.
Well, from your synopsis there, it does sound almost unspeakably boring. Is that the problem with the play, that just not terribly much happens in it?
No, but quite a lot. They eat a lot of ice cream. Does that qualify as stuff happening? When the curtain goes up, everyone's down. Apparently, I've never been to Cincinnati, so perhaps listeners can tell me whether this is true or not. Well, is it true that they eat lots and lots of ice cream?
I was only there very briefly. I have to say I did not to the best of my recollection, I don't recall ever thinking, damn, the people here eat a lot of ice cream.
Well, all I can say is maybe it's closing 7 weeks early so that Katie Holmes can get back on her diet, because seven more weeks of eating that much ice cream, she's not going to fit into her blue jeans. It's just very formulaic. But set that against the play that's across the road from it on 45th Street, 45th Street being the hub of Broadway theater, is the revival, which I've already talked about on this program a month or so ago, but at that point I hadn't seen it, of David Mamet's Glengarry Glen Ross. This is actually an interesting production. It stars Al Pacino, and it has been a critical debacle, but a huge, huge commercial success.
Well, this is the one where the tickets are going for $350 a pop.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Are they going to see the play, or are they going to see Pacino? Silly question.
Well, I got a bargain. I paid $147 to sit in the fifth row of the stalls all the
and
way
And is it $147 you'll never get back?
Yeah. I mean, it's a play I absolutely love. I mean, I think people by now know that David Mamet's 1983 play, which was first actually premiered in London at the National Theatre, is a pretty great play.
Well, see, this is what strikes me, as I'm sure strikes a lot of people. Al Pacino in Glengarry Glen Ross, what could possibly go wrong?
Well, especially because, as everyone probably knows, Al Pacino was in the movie of it and got an Oscar nomination for the film, playing a different part. What's gone wrong is he's now older, not quite as sharp-witted as he used to be in a play in which sharp wits what it's all about. And also, he's really playing to his clack, and he spends most of the performance staring out at the audience with these big saucer eyes, not really connecting with the part, not connecting at all with the rest of the cast. And it's this very sort of strange, bizarre, self-glorifying star turn.
If somebody just put on a production called Al Pacino Stares at the Audience with His Big Saucer Eyes, I'd pay $147 for that.
Well, that's sort of what you're getting, Andrew, at the Schoenfeld Theatre at the moment.
Does that add any charm? Is that Pacino acting as Al Pacino, or is this someone has actually told him to do that?
It's interesting because it's not as if he's a stranger to Broadway, for heaven's sake. He's won Tony Awards in the past. He began in the New York theater, and he's working with the director, Dan Sullivan, who directed him very successfully on Broadway a few years ago as Shylock in The Merchant of Venice. But maybe it's just that there's something about the nature of this play and his gathering celebrity. He is in his 70s. He may never do Broadway again. And he just thinks, you know what? The play is a pretext for me to bask in the aura of my fan base. It could be anything. It could be dead accounts. Except in this case, the accounts are very live, very live.
Pacino notwithstanding, is it worth going to see?
I think if you really love the play, probably not. And if you don't know the play, you won't really get a sense of the play. Oddly, when I took my seat, I was sitting next to a family of four, clearly tourists on holiday in Manhattan. And there was a boy next to me who's 7 or 8. And if you know the world of David Mamet, you probably know that every third word is the F-bomb. And I was thinking, now, should I alert him beforehand? But he was sort of caught up in this Pacino force field, obviously fed the good news by mom and dad of what he was about to see, and he even put his iPad momentarily, I stress momentarily, away so that he could feast on those bug eyes looking out at him from the stage.
It does seem really weird, though, that we've arrived at a pass in which we're saying, yeah, this play's pretty good despite Al Pacino.
Well, you know, there was a fabulous revival of the play 7 years ago with Alan Alda and Liev Schreiber, and these things go in cycles. Let's wait 7 years from now and there'll be another great production. Another starry play, although this one has not been a sellout success, with the lovely Paul Rudd, an actor who's back on screen in This Is 40. He has done theater in England a couple of times, Neil LaBute and Eugene O'Neill, both in London. This is a play called Grace, in which he plays a homicidal religious zealot living in a Florida condo. Now, this is interesting in relation to Glengarry Glen Ross, because Glengarry Glen Ross is about selling Florida condos. So all I could think was maybe one of the condos in Glengarry Glen Ross was sold in some meta-theatrical, you know, theater in the sky, was sold to Paul Rudd's religious homicidal maniac. This is not giving too much away because the play is closing imminently, but it's very strange in the wake of the Newtown Massacre that the play begins with the Paul Rudd character coming on stage with a gun and shooting everyone dead, including himself, and then the play rewinds and we get then the backstory as to how this happened.
The headlines a few weeks ago because a member of the audience was spectacularly ill over half the stalls, which apparently got it very famous. But a lot of the criticism was similar to the criticism that had been directed towards the Katie Holmes play, the Dead Accounts play, which is, you know, reasonably good actor, but a shaky plot and shaky vehicle.
I thought the Paul Rudd play was much more toxic than the Katie Holmes play. The Katie Holmes play is just a not very interesting play about the collision between big city New York and small town Ohio, set against the backdrop of food. This play, Grace, wants to be an expose of religious hypocrisy, but actually it taps into the same gun culture that it wants to criticize. And weirdly, on the way out, I heard lots of audience members talking about getting, renewed ammo. So a strange play for Paul Rudd to do, and I think he's very happy to put it behind him. There are, however, some very good plays in New York.
I was about to say, we've had 8 minutes of terrible plays on Broadway. Someone must have done something good
somewhere.
There
are some wonderful plays in New York, but they don't necessarily have big names. There's a terrific play, a revival of Clifford Odette's 1937 play, Golden Boy, 75th anniversary production at the Belasco Theater, produced by Lincoln Center. It's got a cast of 19. It's in three acts, and it feels like going to a play at the National Theater. It's meaty, it's weighty. It's got a fantastic ensemble. Some of them are well-known, perhaps, to television watchers. Tony Shalhoub from the TV series Monk, who gives a beautiful performance in this as an Italian immigrant father of the main character, who's a young guy who's torn between being a violinist and a boxer. It's really that world of 1930s leftist American drama.
Those not being two professions you can combine.
But two professions
where... The gloves make it difficult.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is, Andrew, the one thing that's common to both, which they fret about a lot in the play, are your hands.
True enough.
There's a lot of worry in the play about what happens to your hands. And then the great, great African-American playwright August Wilson, who's not celebrated enough in the UK, but is a legend in the States. In fact, he has a theater named for him in New York. He died, sadly, a while ago, but he has a superb revival on of his play, The Piano Lesson, which is one of the best things I've seen on either side of the Atlantic in a long time. Again, wonderful ensemble, richly funny, very humane, 3 hours long, brilliant cast of African-American actors, a play about slavery, Depression-era America, lots of humor, steeped in the music of the blues. It's very poetic, very jazzy, and very poignant.
Going back briefly to Clifford Odette's Golden Boy, you said it's 75th anniversary. It hasn't seen Broadway since 1952.
Right.
What does that say about the play? And more importantly, what does that say about Broadway?
Well, I think what it says about the play is that not many producers want to do a play with a cast of 19.
That's not going to make you any money, is it?
No, but this is a not-for-profit production on Broadway, so it doesn't have to make money. It just has to do well, which it's doing for a limited run. It was also the basis for a 1964 musical with Sammy Davis Jr. So there was, called Golden Boy, funnily enough. So there was a period during which the play was superseded by the musical. Now the musical is ancient history and we can go back to the play. Weirdly, when the wonderful Scottish director Bill Bryden was running a company at the National Theatre in London years ago, he started his company with Glengarry Glen Ross and followed it up with Golden Boy. And here they are on Broadway at the same time.
Matt Wolfe, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And no doubt we will be seeing and hearing a lot more of you in 2013 here on The Review. Thank you. The time is just coming up to 58 minutes past the hour. So that brings us to the end of our Saturday Review, I'm afraid to say. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilboa. Thanks also to Oliver Pengilly.
If you're interested in hearing some of Monocle's picks in film, art and TV for 2013, join Robert Bound on Monday at 1900 London time for a special look ahead culture show.
We're handing back over to Georgina Godwin with the weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the year's best Monocle 24 live stories, our guests and our features on a special edition of The Curator.
And don't forget to tune in to the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time.
And if you were interested at all in finding out what it was like in San Moritz, where they broadcast live from the roof of the Hotel Hauser for a week, all you need to do is go to our website, monocle.com. There, a film has been made, ladies and gentlemen, well worth a view. But from the time being, from me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Andrew Muller.
Have a great weekend wherever you are. Goodbye.